It does look like it's 4 o'clock, so we can get started and we'll introduce people. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting the Atlas Society Senior Scholar, Professor Jason Hill, talking about Ayn Rand on civil disobedience. I'd ask everyone to please share the room and also please raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. Jason, thanks so much for doing this topic today. Can you give us a little background about what Rand said about civil disobedience and your assessment of it?
Right. So thanks. There's going to be a little bit of noise because I'm at this. It's not a resort. It's just an off-the-beat hotel in Jamaica. So there's going to be some street noise. I'm traveling around. So if you hear the noisy traffic and motorbikes, it's like being in Italy with the scooters and so on. Rand wrote this essay, or she mentioned civil disobedience in the cashing in the student rebellion. And she basically said that civil disobedience is justifiable in some cases when and if an individual disobeys a law in order to bring it to court as a test case. She made it very clear that in such a case, there was absolute respect for legality, and the protest was directed only at a particular law, which the individual seeks an opportunity to prove to be unjust, right? And she said the same is true of a group of individuals when and if the risks involved are their own. She said that there was no justification for any kind of mass civil disobedience that involves the violation of the rights of others, regardless of whether the demonstrator's goal is good or evil. And here, I think she was talking about the sit-ins during the civil rights movement when blacks would sit at the lunch counters of the Woolworth stores. So she says the forcible occupation of another man's property or the obstruction of a public thoroughfare is a blatant violation of the rights of others, and an attempt to justify it becomes an abrogation of morality. And so she says the rights are not a matter of numbers, and there can be no such thing in law or morality as actions forbidden by to an individual but permitted to a mob. And she said that politically mass civil disobedience is appropriate only as a prelude to civil war, as a declaration of a total break with a country's political institutions. So I sort of want to take that discussion up because I think that her discussion on civil disobedience is a little bit limited in scope. That is, I think she's right that there can be no such thing as civil disobedience when it involves occupying another person's private property. That is, no matter how much you believe that you have access to another person's private property, if that person doesn't want you on their private property, you cannot occupy it. So I think in that sense, civil disobedience is inappropriate. You do not have the right to occupy somebody's private property, even on the tenet that they're excluding you on immoral grounds. We might call them immoral and unethical, but they do have a legal right to their private property. So Rand, I think, was correct on that aspect. But I think that a wider discussion of civil disobedience that entails an unjust law or a set of unjust laws that are ensconced in an illiberal state or ensconced in an infrastructure that is itself illiberal or veering towards illiberality, a discussion of that order has to take place. So that's where I want to pick up because I think Rand's discussion were limited and presupposed an infrastructure of moral legality, right? That is, laws affixed to a set of moral principles that themselves are protective of individual rights. And somewhere in the interpretation of the law or the scope of its application, an abrogation of rights occurred. But here, one still shows a basic respect for the legal institutions because the legal institutions themselves are still protective and are still dedicated to, by and large, the protection of individual rights. So one does not really engage in massive civil disobedience that violate the rights of others in those cases, because one can ostensibly point to the ways in which there might just be an error of reasoning or a sort of misapplication in the scope of particular laws. But ostensibly, empirically, the legislative and the judiciary are still committed to protecting individual rights. So I think those are the easy cases. But I want to advance a thesis that mass civil disobedience can be morally necessary in order to force the hand of a law in a direction that protects individual rights long after, say, let's say something like stare decisis has been established. And I'll take two examples. Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion for women, and it's still on the books, so abortion is still legal for women. And let's say Loving versus Virginia, which ended the criminalization of interracial marriage in the United States in the landmark case in 1967. So I think both cases involve the protection of the inviolable autonomy, sovereignty, and the ownership in one's body. That is, there are these are the preconditions, the material conditions that, among other things, need to be in place for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to take place. So the idea that the original framing, for example, that Alita said that the original framing that legitimized Roe v. Wade was fallacious is problematic because it presupposes, among other things, that the sovereignty, the autonomy, and the unassailable ownership of property in a woman's body is negotiable. If the Supreme Court were to overturn, let's say, Loving versus Virginia, by some specious form of reasoning that it, violated the doctrine of American federalism that relegated marriage as a subject traditionally reserved for state law, I mean, ratification of the 14th Amendment notwithstanding, I think here a case of mass civil disobedience of such a law would be proper. And here the violation would not result in the violation of anyone's individual rights, right? So I think people in that case who want to intermarry ought to just rush to the courts, and we would have two forms of mass civil disobedience: the people who are marrying interracial couples and the couples who are exercising their right to marry a person of their choice. So civil disobedience, I think, in that sense would be restorative and corrective. And by the way, we see that despite Roe v. Wade still being the law of the land, that the governor of Oklahoma, Kevin Stitt, has signed into law a few weeks ago, banning abortion from the moment of conception. So here the law has clearly become tyrannical, despotic, and I think in a completely hegemonic and totalizing manner, a violation of the inalienability clause vis-a-vis a woman's constitutional and individual right to have an abortion. And he signed this law that makes abortion illegal from the moment of conception, despite the fact that abortion on the federal level is still legal for all women in the United States of America. So one is under no obligation here to respect the notion of legality any more than one would be obliged to respect a law that, let's say, arbitrarily deprived a man or woman of his or her property because, communally speaking, by some sort of norms, communal norms that have been morphed into standard, they have become codified into norms. The norms I'm speaking here is that a person owns too many houses, he has too much property, and by the norms of some sort of communal standards, the government is going to deprive that person of their property. I think that's the same thing with abortion. They're nothing more than communal and religious norms that have been codified. So in the case of interracial marriage, for example, a revocation of Loving versus Virginia would result in something like the recriminalization of conscience, and the attendant judgment that results from the exercise of one's conscience. And also it would result in the denial of the right of association. So I think mass civil disobedience is not appropriate as a prelude to civil war. It is appropriate as we see a rise in statism and the concomitant perversion of a nation's judiciary and legislative bodies. I think the Oklahoma ban, which to me is a sign of a sort of fright, along with Christian nationalism that accompanies it or that legitimizes it, is a sign of the coming theocracy. It should be a frightful occurrence to all. So when we have, as we do, an extremist activist majority on the Supreme Court who thinks that its job is to fix what it sees as the errors of the past and to reintroduce mores of the past as standards, and who can recodify community mores from the past into a paradigmatic schema for the present, the future. I think civil disobedience is the ultimate, how can I put it? I think civil disobedience is a utilization, I want to say, of our moral agency to restrain unjust laws that are already evicted from the ambit of moral legality. Right? So a civilized people can have no truck with what I would call outlaw laws that systemically abrogate their own inviolability. So Rand says that the advocates of civil disobedience must admit that their purpose is intimidation. And this can be true or not, but it can be a good form of intimidation. But I don't think this is any more the case than the establishment of certain laws that result or are an expression of tyranny, not against the will of a people, but against the unassailable, inviolable, and inalienable rights of the individual. So criminal law, those that are not antecedently affixed to moral principles, or what I would call sinkhole laws, destroy the individual's inalienable right to pursue a life of liberty and the pursuit of happiness along with life. So law enforcement, right, assumes the job of protecting our rights by enforcing the law in any contestation vis-a-vis disputes among persons. But I think that some wrongs are so wrong that we assume the default duty of enforcing ourselves. And I think that the Oklahoma anti-abortion law is so egregious, a violation of a woman's right to the ownership of her body. This has to be assumed in order to make sense of the inalienability clause by granting personhood status to, I don't know if you can even call it a fetus, it's pieces of protoplasm, and allowing status to that conglomeration of cells to supersede the right of an indisputable human being, a woman. I think it's so evil a phenomenon that a moral principle that secures massive disobedience of such a law, which violates federal abortion law, could easily be established. So I think what we have here is a confection of hatred for women's rights or a misplacement of personhood status to a few human cells that's going on. That's one of two options. And what we need really is a confederacy of conscientious objectors, that is pregnant women and doctors, really disobeying the law outright en masse, which would showcase a few things. One would be civil disobedience becomes a way of upholding what I would call the moral dimension of a law that has been overturned or a law that violates the moral principle that secures one's inalienable individual rights. And two, mass civil disobedience in the above case, I think, involves the sovereign mass becoming the deputized stand-in for a corrupt judiciary or a legislative body, as in the case of Governor Stitt, who's a corrupt human being, I think, whose perversion of the law has fallen so low, so far below what I would call a decency threshold, that it can be no longer trusted to act in the interest of the individual. So the mass cases of civil disobedience involves exercising the law of nature that is the basis for one's inalienability and inviolability, and we would act as the judge in our own lives here. So the judiciary has so egregiously violated a person's rights that in some cases I think it's just too burdensome to engage in civil disobedience as a test case against an unjust law, because we're here talking about laws that are evil, such as the one stripping. We can just point to any number of them. I think the Oklahoma law that criminalizes abortion from the moment of conception is one such law. We could point to laws stripping Jews of their various rights during the Weimar Republic and under Nazism. Laws constructed under a criminal regime, I don't think, hold any proper legal or moral weight upon a people. And so mass civil disobedience in such cases seem to be appropriate. They are checks and balances and correctives of judicial activism, judicial extremism, or a reactionary court or courts. In other words, when the legislative body and the judiciary have, by means of certain laws, declared war on the inviolable sovereignty, autonomy, and right of ownership in one's body, I think it has, broadly speaking, recused or evicted itself from the realm of proper governance. And its egregious laws achieve, among other things, or results in the cancellation of what I would call the juridical personality of the individual. So deracination, de-identification, stripping the individual of the stuff that constitutes his or her personal identity, that is, access to one's values and the application of them, as is the case of, would be the case of criminalization of intermarriage, and in the case of anti-abortion laws, using one's body in a way to enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness by making deliberate choice here regarding a pregnancy, or you just making a choice about one's reproductive apparatus in a manner that would affect the rest of one's life. So I've gone beyond the mere test case justification of engaging in civil disobedience, and I've said that laws, or I'm going to say that laws are primarily, in a free society, there to protect individual rights, not invoke communal mores that are justified as being in the public interest and then imposed on the rest of society. This is collectivist law and totalitarianism or a sign of radical democracy. So the individual in such a case is living in a state of nature where a powerful minority, in this case, five extremists on a Supreme Court, get to determine the fate and destiny of millions of women vis-a-vis the loss of control over their bodies. Or the individual has returned to a state of nature, as in this Oklahoma law, where a majority of would-be theocratic residents are invested with the power to authorize their governor to illegalize abortion from conception. So finally, in wrapping up, I'll just say that ideas and moral suasion have roles to play in a civilized and liberal society, but they take time. And the invasive and totalitarian needs activism, or when a state becomes very invasive and totalitarian in its judiciary or judicial and legislative behavior, so to speak, it needs activism now, not just books and speeches. So something like a legal insurrection against a legislative executive set of bodies on the local level or on the judicial level, federally or local, that declares a wholesale war is proper as an offensive against such laws that I think they passed. They're way past the unjust moniker. They have passed into corruption. So I think just as criminals and rogue nations that systemically violate rights of people have evicted themselves from the ambit of rights, the fiduciaries of the law who act in this egregious manner vis-a-vis the laws have evicted themselves as custodians of the law, simpliciter. And what we must do is act as their deputized stand-in, as engagers in radical and massive disobedience to force the moral dimension of a law that's been abolished via a perversion of the law itself. There's much more to say, but believe it or not, that was just about 20 minutes of me talking, so I'll stop there.
Okay, well, that's great. I have a lot I could touch on, but I want to defer to TAS founder David Kelly. Did you have a question for Professor Hill?
No, excuse me. I think this is a very interesting topic, and to my mind, convincing case that Jason has made. I'm going to, but I don't have a particular question at this point. So let me turn the floor back to you and to others who may have questions. I'm sure there will be many. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for that. And we encourage you to share the room and raise your hand if you want to get involved with the discussion. A couple of things struck me. Do we have different criteria for when something is, qualifies? I mean, I know obviously abortion's up there, but there are some things that, immigration, for example, they're not following federal law to have sanctuary cities, or, marijuana legalization. They're ignoring federal laws in that case because it's important. In some cases, they claim it's life-saving. And so I'm just curious, is that all, because that's a trend we've seen lately where they kind of, change the law by ignoring federal law. And in your case with abortion, you're saying it warrants a type of civil disobedience. But in these cases, it's happening in just a kind of quiet way where the states are facilitating it. And I'm curious if, you see that as valid, or if it's the same thing or different?
Well, I think that there are certain laws that have to, before we engage in civil disobedience, that they have to have exhausted all the legal channels. That is, they have to, as Rand properly said, they have to be sort of like a test case. And we engage in civil disobedience as a test case when they have exhausted, they've been exhausted, they've gone through various legal channels, and then they have failed, and then we sort of engage in civil disobedience. And then there are certain laws that, violate stare decisis. That is, they've been, like abortion, it's precedent. Gay marriage is another such law. Loving versus Virginia is another such law that we are morally obligated, I think, to engage in civil disobedience under those conditions when stare decisis is established and an set of activists, extremists, take it that the original framing was fallacious fallacious, and they're going to correct it. I think with immigration, it does not involve... So, and let me say another thing. And then there are certain laws that are so eviscerative of people's dignity and are in such violation of their sovereignty and their autonomy that they're so unassailable that they're just not negotiable, that we engage in mass civil disobedience because it's like bargaining with a criminal. It's like, a criminal comes into your house and says, your money or your life. If you've got a gun, you shoot him right away. You don't try to negotiate with a thief, because your life is not negotiable. Your sovereignty, your autonomy, the inalienability of your rights are not up for negotiation. I don't see that as being on par with what's happening on the southern border with immigration. That's why I use the litmus test of a decency threshold. There are certain unassailable, inviolable rights that we possess. So I would say something like a seatbelt law, which is clearly an unjust law, but it's not an evil law, because being forced to wear a seatbelt it's a violation of your sovereignty, but it's not eviscerative of your dignity. And it's not such a violation of a material condition that it's not so comprehensive a violation of your right that it really comprehensively interferes with your capacity to call a good life for yourself, where certainly something like abortion legalizing abortion is certainly a case that not just potentially, it actually threatens your capacity to call a conception of the good life yourself. It comprehensively dwarfs, compromises your capacity to achieve life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I think we have to sort of hierarchize these violations of rights that affect us before we engage in something like mass civil disobedience, or else we just have anarchy and chaos, right? I don't want to give carte blanche for everything that offends us or every law that annoys us, every violation of a law that upsets us, that even is a violation of our individual rights, is grounds for massive civil disobedience. I think we have to think long and hard about which of those laws are so comprehensive and so totalizing that they stymie our capacity to exercise our agency, to call a conception of a good life for ourselves. And I just don't see the immigration issue as being on par with the abortion issue.
Okay, that's fair. There's some grayer issues that I can't even think of yet that it'd probably be more complicated. But I want to get to JP. JP, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you, Jason and Jennifer. David, I would like to get your thoughts on the parallels to the current trend in authoritarianism. And also a characterization of was Gout's Gulch, for example, in Atlas Shrugged, a very, very shining example of civil disobedience. And also in the end, if you have knowledge of it, there's an author of late libertarianism by the name of Samuel Edward Clocking that is said to have corresponded with Ayn Rand a lot, and who wrote an essay by the name of An Agorist Primer, I'm not sure if that's correctly spelled, which talks about applied economics, applied counter-economics, libertarianism, and agorism. I would leave it at that. If there's anything that makes sense from that, then I'll appreciate your opinions.
Right. Thanks for that. Well, as far as the authoritarianism is concerned, I do think that the current rush, for example, of certain states to illegalize abortion on the premise that they're sure that the Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade is ought to be frightening for freedom lovers or anyone who just, you don't even have to be a freedom lover, you just have to respect individual rights, because it is not just a flagrant violation of the law that is still the law of the land, that is Roe v. Wade. But it is a creepy form of Christian nationalism that is wielding nothing but religious mores, codifying religious mores and norms into something that is used to justify these primitive anti-abortion laws. And so that's one area where I see the creeping rise of a kind of authoritarianism that is traceable back to communal mores, religious mores. We could talk about other forms of authoritarianism, but I want to move on to the next question. David, I want to invite David, because David shared some information with me that he had already written about regarding whether Gulch was a form of civil disobedience. My sense is that it's not, because just simply not working is not a violation of a law. Like, I am a professor, so if I decide tomorrow to resign from my job on the premise that the culture is so bankrupt, which it is, And there's nothing but putrefaction and mediocrity out there, which there are. I don't think I'd be engaging in an act of civil disobedience because there's, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, any law on the book that says I have to work, as there are laws that says if I had children, I have to send them to public schools. So if I pulled my children out of government schools and decided not to give them an education, I'd be committing an act of civil disobedience. So we have laws in the book that says, you know, all children have to be educated or something like that. So I'm not sure that Galt and his comrades, if Rand would not want me to use that term, his fellow fighters in arms were committing civil disobedience, because simply withdrawing your talents and withdrawing your services from society, I don't know, constitutes breaking a law, unless in the dystopic sense, there are laws that condemn you to work. But in a properly speaking, in a semi-free society or a free society, I don't think it would. I don't see Galt or Hank Reardon or any of the others committing civil disobedience as more just committing acts of heroism, that is, with literally withdrawing their talents from the world, bearing the consequences, and their consequences that they had to bear in order to show how much the world really does depend on talent and genius and brilliance and a set of skills that are indispensable for the advancement of civilization. David, what do you I mean, I know you've written on this.
Yes, I'm what Jason was referring to is a talk that I gave some years ago on, it was called The Sanction of the Victim, but it was about the strike of Atlas. And I was, I think Jason's right. This is not a case of civil disobedience in the usual normal sense that he's describing. It's more akin to a labor strike. But there are structural parallels, and I developed this structure and the parallels in this talk. There are parallels not only with the standard kind of labor strike, but also with the form of civil disobedience that involves passive resistance of the kind that Martin Luther King engaged in, where you are violent, violating a law, and you are accepting the reaction of the authorities and actually expecting their brutality, with the idea that it will shame the authorities and will generate public support for your cause. So in that sense, there's definitely a parallel between the strike in Atlas Shrugged and some of the broad movements like Gandhi, or as I said, Martin Luther King. and I'd be happy to share that the video and PowerPoints with anyone who's interested. But I think this is a very high level analogy. When you get down into the nitty gritty of the kind of movement or civil disobedience that Jason has been talking about, I think, yeah, the strikers in Atlas did not violate laws. They did it along the way. They just ignored them. And at the end, of course, they fought back to prevent the torture of their hero. But the by and large, they were simply withdrawing. They were on strike. And that's It in fact violated the draconian laws that were imposed in part two of Atlas Shrugged, no one may leave his job. but they didn't make that public, they just disappeared. No one could find them, they were hidden. So big differences.
Well, that's good. Now, obviously, it seems like you focus a lot of this on violations of the law, and I can understand that criteria. You know, sometimes I think of civil disobedience as like reacting to the slow boil approach that it seems like society's doing on us sometimes, and it can, you know, so I think of like the FBI agents or the guys that were at that protest last year that, you know, became a meme of FBI agents and now we're laughing at them. Or, you know, when they talk about Governor Whitmer being kidnapped and it turned out it was a bunch of FBI agents that, you know, and maybe like a couple of informants and, you know, we're laughing at that. And I mean, on one level, it's terrible that we're laughing about the unraveling of the rule of law, but at the type of civil disobedience. It seems like it anyway.
You mean what seems like a type of civil disobedience?
Just like laughing at the system, mocking the system. Sometimes it can manifest as like supporting the candidate that they tell us we shouldn't like.
Well, yeah, I mean, that could be a form of civil disobedience in sort of colloquial sense of the term. But I think that civil disobedience, for it to have any kind of conceptual traction or upshot, has to be distinctly positioned in relation to particular laws and not even mores that have become cultural practices or not even norms. Let's stick with mores because I think mores are stronger than norms. Not even mores that get codified into cultural practices. I think civil disobedience is really an action that is in defiance of codified law that one is in disagreement with. I mean, for those of you who are interested, this book was written a long time ago. I did write a book called Civil Disobedience and the Politics of Identity, When We Should Not Get Along, and I sort of lay out, I mean, nobody buys that book anymore, it's so old. But I did sort of lay out the criteria for what counts as civil disobedience and when we should not get along and when we should not have truck with certain laws. So I want to make a distinction here and say that in the colloquial sense, it does seem often like we're engaging in civil disobedience when we mock certain mores that have become codified but are not enacted on the level of policy. But for civil disobedience, to really have any kind of resonance and traction, it has to be an act that one has to really be breaking the law. And that's why I said, you know, I am in disagreement partially with Rand on the idea that engaging in mass civil disobedience is a prelude to a civil war. I do think all of us should support those individuals living in Oklahoma where abortion has been banned from the level of fertilization. I mean, that governor, Kevin Stitt, is really quite an evil man. And I think in that case, massive disobedience, where any woman who finds herself pregnant and every doctor who's willing to perform an abortion en masse, if there are 10,000 women in a month who want to have an abortion and there are doctors willing to perform it, that would be a case of massive disobedience that should be enacted. What are they going to do, arrest 10,000 doctors and 10,000 people? Well, that would be a case of forcing the hand of the law, because if you have that many people committing massive disobedience, that's not a prelude to any kind of civil war. That is each person, as I've said, we can call them a sovereign mass, but each person acting as a deputized stand-in for the judge, for the judiciary that has failed them, for the legislative body, in this case, the governor of the executive body on the local level, the governor who has acted illegally because Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land. He's acted illegally by creating a law authorized by his constituents, his Christian nationalist constituents, to enact a law that is in violation of federal law. So I'm spending a lot of time on this because I do think that there are certain actions that seem to be acts of civil disobedience, but it for it to really have its resonance, and it has to be an action that is in violation of the law. What are these pregnant women going to do in Oklahoma who find themselves, by the way, you don't even know you're pregnant at the moment of fertilization, right? So this is ridiculous. So what are these women going to do when at 6 weeks or 4 weeks, probably, they find out they're pregnant? If they decided, if a confederacy of doctors and a confederacy of women decide en masse that they're just going to have abortions, that's massive disobedience. And I'm arguing that that's a kind of massive disobedience I think we should all support, we should all uphold morally. And people should have a right to engage morally in that kind of massive disobedience.
Okay, thanks. Clark, welcome to the stage.
Yes, thank you for holding this presentation. I guess I've always looked at this issue primarily as a private-public issue. I'm thinking, of course, of speakers who are invited to university campus where their protesters will invoke what's often called a heckler's veto. They won't let the speaker speak. And, you know, a lot of universities today, since they don't really understand private property or property rights the way that most of the people in this room today do, they will say, well, you know, the protesters, they have a right to protest. They have free speech rights. So, you know, we'll give them a warning the first time. But generally, you know, well, we all know that there are instances where speakers just weren't allowed to speak because the people against their views sent so many people to the talk that, you know, it was just impossible to, without the university or place actually arresting people, which I think is what they should do. If property rights mean anything, they should actually arrest people who were violating the rights of the university or the organization that's actually sponsoring the speaker. Those persons' rights are violated. And I guess the most recent instance that I can think of off the top of my head is the protesters who visited, if that's the correct word, Justice Kavanaugh's home. And again, you know, on public property, the private, you know, sidewalk, I suppose, in front of his home, that's perfectly legal. The issue, of course, today is most people who aren't objectivist or who don't understand, you know, private property rights don't think that you know, that it stops at public property. They think they have the right to go up to, you know, the justice's home, knock on his door, you know, stand in his property or in his private front yard. And of course, we all know, those of us in this room, that's completely wrong. But to me, that's where the issue, that's where the rubber hits the road. So I'm interested, Jason, and what are your views on protesters who did, in fact, from what I've heard, you know, they did, in fact, go to Justice Kavanaugh's home, and they did pretty much prevent, you know, I mean, they basically violated any sense of privacy he may have had. What are your thoughts about that, Jason?
Well, as I said, I started off the talk by saying I completely think that Rand is right, that despite the good intentions of those who engage in civil disobedience, that you have no right to access another person's property, even if you think that accessing their property is the right thing and you think that their denial of your access is evil, right? Let's say, so we're talking about blacks in the 1960s, sitting at the Woolworth counters demanding to be served, and people saying, the owner saying, you know, we don't want to serve you because we don't want to deal with blacks. I think that on a strictly property rights basis, on a legal basis, people who own their private property have a legal right to not have people on their property. No, I think every one of us in this room would defend the legal right, but ought to say morally, you're a piece of scum, you're a piece of crap, because you're using skin color as a criterion for excluding people from your property, and that's just a heinous, horrible criterion to use. So I think I would use the same principle in arguing that as much as I think I'm totally against the five extremists on the Supreme Court, who I think are all Christian nationalists, who want to take women back to the Dark Ages. I despise all of them, philosophically, that is. I don't know them personally, but I think their goals are heinous and reprehensible, especially Leto. You do not have the right to carry your wrath and your rage onto a person's private property, his home, which is where he belongs. Carry that, get a permit, like everybody else, march in the street. And the civil disobedience, Clark, I think that I'm championing here is the mass civil disobedience, is the breaking of a law that is egregious and wrong. That is, if you get pregnant, if a woman gets pregnant, or if any number of women get pregnant, and if they're brave enough to do it, they ought to break the law by having an abortion. And they ought to do this in the thousands, en masse, in flagrant violation of an evil law that pretends to be writing a wrongful framing of a law that was passed in the 70s. So that's the kind of civil disobedience I'm defending. But I would never defend, as much as I think these five extremists are reprehensible individuals, should they overturn Roe v. Wade, which they probably will. They're activists and they're reactionary. That doesn't give anyone the right to even threaten their lives. That's not what civil disobedience is about, or to occupy their property. That's not what civil disobedience. You don't set foot on some other's private property because you disagree with them. That's not how that's just not how you challenge a law at all.
Clark, you have more to say?
Well, actually, that's great. I agree completely, Jason. And again, I would just wrap up by saying, yeah, unfortunately today, many people, who don't understand these issues the way you do, and presumably most everybody else in the room, think that, may not, when Roe is overturned, and I agree, it probably will be, I think there will be more visits to more Supreme Court justices' homes and such. But you've stated it as well as it can be stated, Jason. So thank you so much for that.
Thanks.
Just to add on to that a little bit, I do think that one of the issues is that so they arrested someone outside Kavanaugh's home, and I mean obviously you're against that, and you stated that clearly. But what we saw, for example, in 2020 with the mass civil disobedience, and we were told that it was mostly peaceful protesters, and there was an implication that we basically had to accept the bad because so many of them were peaceful that we couldn't, stand up against them. And it becomes this kind of sliding scale of, how peaceful you are at what time of day. And that's just, that's something there was a basic call for mass civil disobedience over what happened to George Floyd. And I mean, you can argue that that should have happened or that shouldn't have happened. But either way, I mean, I think everyone agrees it got out of control a little bit. And that is something to consider, at least logistically.
Right. So I think that people have a right of assembly, and we've had various marches, the hippies and the yippies, and the $1 million march for men, and the women's rights movement, and gay activists. So we have a history in this country of people seeking petition and license and ordin, granting them permission to march peacefully, and whether one agrees that the public thoroughfares are for cars and public passage or for demonstration is one thing. I happen to think that with the proper procedures, people should be allowed to peacefully demonstrate and register their protest. And we've had a history of that in this country. But the idea that somehow that gives you then license to vandalize personal property, that gives other people license to vandalize property and express their, in many cases, understandable rage into some kind of amorphous, chaotic violence against people who have not harmed them. That is, you know, you're going to smash a store window, you're going to loot the stuff from Dolce & Gabbana and Prada and say this is our reparations now, and you're going to burn down black businesses. This is a gross violation of property rights against people who have done you no harm. And this is not a case of civil disobedience. It's just a case of wanton violence that should have been dealt with quite seriously. There should have been arrests and
prosecution. What do you consider civil disobedience?
What's that?
What do you personally, not judicially, but like, what do you consider disobedience socially?
Well, I've been giving an entire talk on it.
Do you acknowledge classism in capitalistic society?
Do I recognize class? I recognize classism as predating capitalist society. I mean, feudal Europe.
What about now?
Lily, give him a chance to finish.
Yes, sir. Sorry.
I recognize classism as predating capitalism. I recognize capitalism as the best economic system, the best system to eradicate classism at all, to give people a chance to achieve some sort of social upward mobility where they're not locked into social classes as they are in much of Europe today. But I think classism predates capitalism on a very, very strong, almost nefarious level, and that capitalism gives people the best opportunity to escape from their role identities and their class, the social classes in which they're born. I don't think it's something unique to capitalism at all.
I have a question, Jason. In your hypothesis, where do you become to measure the trickle-down method in capitalism, where there is like one that has the most eggs and then trickles down to the lesser then?
I don't ascribe to any kind of social utility as justifying capitalism. I think capitalism is a system of trading among and between persons for mutual advantage and mutual gain.
Do you believe that individuals should be policed to their value? So let's say, who says that this guy next door to me has the right to own 90% of all the eggs in my city? So I've been forced to go to
the country. We're kind of getting off the topic here.
No, that's exactly capitalism, because one guy has all the eggs and I go to him and he decides the price.
Capitalism isn't in the title.
Well,
okay, you know, my bad, Jason.
Let me just briefly answer. If the person in your neighborhood has 90% of all the eggs, and you can ostensibly show that he has not acquired those eggs through government help, through force, but through his own or her own industry and through her own industriousness, and through no government help, no franchises, no subsidies, no special protection, but just through her own industriousness and persistence and inventiveness, she owns 90% of the eggs.
I love you, Jason.
I love you too, honey.
Sorry about that. I can't stand interrupters. It's like, yeah, the lefties don't have to follow the rules. That actually brings up something. There's some people that are responding to this double standard in the law, where it's like, you know, they care about some protests but not other protests. They, you know, care about historically marginalized groups, but, you know, it's not being applied fairly to everyone, and that's part of like a source for anger as well. I'm just curious what you think of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, most people are not going to think inconsistently in terms of fundamental principles. I mean, they think sort of incrementally, or they think they think very strategically, and they think in terms of what serves a strategic interest at one point, and don't sort of apply don't think comprehensively in terms of unifying principles the way that Rand talked about thinking in terms of fundamental principles. And so they're going to be at a loss, and they're going to be contradictory, and there's just their thinking is going to be sloppy and messy. I don't think a lot of them are ill-intentioned or ill-willed in their approach. They're just at the behest of their emotions and illogical form of thinking, because there's no unifying principle to tie the seemingly disparate ideas that they have together. And so, I mean, that's one of the things that I read a lot of thinkers. I discovered Rand at 20, almost 20, but I did discover Bertrand Russell, Kant, and Nietzsche before Rand. But one of the things I will say about Ayn Rand is that she really did give me a method of cognition. That is this notion of, I never got that from Kant, and I certainly didn't get it from Nietzsche, and I didn't get it from Bertrand Russell, who my father piled on me when I was 15. But Rand did, you know, gave me a method of cognition of learning to think in terms of fundamentals and unifying principles. And I think most people, in the absence of that, are just going to have this sort of inchoate, it's like Rand said, you know, when she gave these examples of someone said, well, I can understand why it's bad to nationalize the coal industry, but what about the oil industry? Why is it, you know, they just couldn't apply the principle and see why nationalization was bad simpliciter.
Right, for any industry. No,
for industry, right. And it's not even national, not even real. And then when you think even deeper, you're not even nationalizing the industry. You're nationalizing man's brain, because the industries are just a product of his thinking or her thinking, of one's thinking, really. So it's the brain that you're nationalizing, you know, to take the abstraction to its highest register. But I think that most people, Scott, are just devoid of that method, that amazing method of cognition that Rand passed on to many of us.
Sure. That makes sense. In the final moments, thoughts on the Canadian truckers and their protests?
I mean, I have great sympathy for them. I mean, I think we, again, I'm going to be very principled here, and I'm going to say that if we allow for the protesters to register their protests or their disaffection with the law in certain cases, that the truckers have every right to protest against mandates and all kinds of incursions against their liberties and their freedoms. So I do support the truckers. I think that the way that they have been treated has been disgraceful. They have every right to register their protest, as do any other groups. And really, they have behaved, comparatively speaking, when you look at how other protesters have use the privilege of the right of assembly and the right to peaceful protest, how that has sort of manifested itself in violence, that the truckers, apart from just committing noise pollution with the honking, have behaved with, you know, a kind of great care and have not morphed into acts of violence. And so I do think that they're sending a message. I happen not to be an anti-vaxxer. I was born and raised in Jamaica, so which is a third world country. So I was vaccinated for smallpox, for tuberculosis, for everything under the sun, which I think is one of the reasons I've never contracted COVID. So I deeply believe in vaccinations, but I respect and honor those who it's like I don't smoke, but I'm pro-smokers, right? I'll fight to the death for people to smoke. I don't own a gun, but I'm a Second Amendment absolutist, and I'll never own a gun, but I'll respect the right of those. So I feel the same way about the truckers. That is, they have, in fact, they're securing the freedoms for the rest of us, and I think they should be respected. I think they should not just be tolerated. I think they should be respected, because I think they're fighting a battle that is actually worth fighting. That is the ownership of your body, everything that I spoke about today, the sovereignty, the ownership, and you as being, all of us as being the inviolable owners of our bodies. And that's something that's worth taking regardless of how one feels about vaccinations and anything else.
Well, that's a great note to end it on. Next week, we'll be back on Clubhouse. I'll be hosting a social hour with Lawrence Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern, and Thursday at 4 p.m. Richard Salzman will be doing an Ask Me Anything on capitalism. Wednesday, the Atlas Society asks Marcia Enright. That should be a good one. So, but in the meantime, Professor Hill, thank you so much for doing this topic, and we'll look forward to seeing everyone next time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Scott. Thank you, Jennifer.